Today's Tennis Podcast. I'm Steve Smith, along with my co-host today, Lawrence Hyde, episode 188. Let me tell you a little about Lawrence. He's from Missouri, but he does a great English accent, and I told him to really be international. Just stay with the accent. Let me hear you say, I'm Lawrence Hyde from Missouri.
I'm Lawrence Hyde from Missouri.
Yeah, but stay with that English accent. A lot of people get great jobs in the U.S. because they have the English accent.
Yeah.
More so than the Irish accent, South African, so. Australian. I think the English accent is number one. Another thing is smile at the camera. Give us a smile. Come on. Doesn't he look like a hockey player? Missing the front teeth. He's going to have that taken care of in a couple months. He has had a problem with some infections, right?
But yeah, two infections.
When I was a young kid, that's a badge of honor in ice hockey. I was hoping that...
Makes you look tough, right?
Get a puck in the mouth and lose some teeth. Have the sign of a hockey player. Hey, we got to get the show on the road. Great guest we're going to call Mark Bay. I've done some research on Mark. Known Mark a long time. What a background. But I think we should just call him up and get going. His experiences are vast. I think one thing you could just say that, I think you have to pinch yourself if you're part of the Davis Cup team. He just spent some time assisting Bob Bryan, somebody I think he's known since he was 12 or 13 years old. But this guy's a lifer, and he knows tennis backwards, forwards, and upside down. So let's call up Mark Bay.
Let's do it.
Stay with the English accent, Lawrence.
Yeah, well, I'll try.
Your job is to keep me on track. Senior moments, baby.
Hopefully it doesn't fade out.
Yes, just stay focused.
I will.
Lawrence is here for a couple months studying tennis, fellow tennis coach. Respect his dedication. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning, Mark Bay. Thank you for being a guest on the Great Bay Tennis Podcast.
Happy to be here.
I'm sitting at the table with Lawrence Hyde from England. And I told the listeners what an impressive background you have. And I said, we could just top it off by saying, how many people get to be part of the Davis Cup team for the country. But what we do in our podcast, we tease and say we start out with what type of baby food you ate. But I know your listeners will find out shortly, if they don't already know you, that you have nonstop passion for tennis. But tell us how you got connected in the game. We'll get this thing rolling.
I grew up in an extremely challenging neighborhood on the west side of Chicago, playing baseball to start and being a Boy Scout. And there was a lot of kids in the area that were probably getting into trouble. And most certainly, my family didn't want me to follow into those footsteps. And my aunts, who played, would sometimes pull me out of the street with my friends and take me down to Columbus Park, which is a few miles down on the borderline of the west side of Chicago and Oak Park. And she would have me pick up balls for her or help her or sometimes hit with her. And so that's how it started. I was probably 10 years old, going on 11 during that time. And it was something that I was doing for fun, but not doing completely serious as of yet. It was more of an exposure opportunity there. But then after I stopped playing baseball, and then we transitioned and moved to the south side of Chicago in Hyde Park, which is by University of Chicago, tennis was a lot more received there. I started playing a little bit more of that, coupled with basketball. So baseball was more fifth and sixth grade, basketball seventh, eighth, and ninth, and tennis was starting to get mixed in there. And then eventually I realized I was only going to be short in stature, not going to be tall enough, and was starting to lose playing time based on some politics and some height. And so I thought, gosh, if I focus on this tennis, I might actually have an opportunity to play a sport in college. So then baseball and basketball went to the wayside, and tennis became, obviously on the forefront.
With Boy Scouts, I have a brother who has a PhD, and he was one merit badge short of being an Eagle Scout. I have three older brothers who were all scouts, but my parents moved 150 miles south, and I really wasn't a scout. How long did you stay with that? Did you go few years being in a Boy Scout program?
Yeah, Troop 139, first class Boy Scout.
The merit badge. I think that's something that's got so many great things have gone away.
And that was almost like grad school. To be able to earn one of those, the amount of work that you had to do was rather expensive.
Yeah, for sure. Now I used to send people off to the library to look up quotes. Now they can just kind of push some buttons on their phone. But how long did it take you to get into tournament tennis as a junior?
I never played a 12 and under match. So I was playing at 11 and 12 through that process, but I started playing local tournaments as a first year 14 at 13 years of age.
And some of the role models, who'd you look up to in your youth?
Who did I look up to in professional tennis or in my life?
No, both. I mean, professional tennis, but even on the local scene. I know when the Midwest tournament was called the Westerns, that was a tough tournament to win. We always discuss why was so many really good tennis players from the Midwest. Was it family values? Was it the appreciation of indoor court time? It's a fact that the Midwest produced more pro players before the advent of the academy, when people would just stay home. And I think another thing too is a lot of people grow up in the Midwest. I think that they understand sports because they're fans of the Big Ten. But you know, both. I mean, the pro on the pro tour, but then also juniors.
Go ahead. Role model of the pros. I customized it. I had my own hybrid version of what I thought the ideal player was. So I started really playing in 1979 with a wood racket. And so I'm just old enough to be old, I always say. So I thought Borg's topspin forehand was really cool. I thought Jimmy Connors' ability to take the backhand early and take the returns on the rise was really strong. And then I thought McEnroe's ability to play the net and just move people around and come in and just intercept the balls was something that I most certainly wanted to do. So I tried to have Borg's forehand topspin. I tried to have Jimmy Connors taking the ball on the backhand early. And I tried to have John McEnroe serving volley ability with Arthur Ashe's attitude. So I customized my own little role model, and that was sort of the type of person I wanted to be on the court.
I read that with Arthur Ashe. I tease and tell people I played like Arthur Ashe's brother, Jack Ashe. Yeah. Anyway, with Katrine Adams, where does she fit in? I read that she was instrumental or a role model you looked up to. Why don't you tell us who she is? And
yeah, exactly. So Katrine Adams is a former NCAA doubles champion, went to Northwestern. She is the same age as I am. We were both born in 1968. She is an August birthday. I'm a December birthday. And when I started playing at Columbus Park, everyone at the park kept talking about this young girl that played at Garfield Park and how amazing she was. And I had heard the folklore of this Katrina Adams. And so finally I went to a tournament, National 17th Magazine tournament that was held at Midtown Chicago, which is a very big club in the middle of the city. And I went and watched her play, and I was amazed how good she was, and the fact that she had come from the neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. So I think to some extent, the competitive jealousy of, oh my gosh, you know, she's from similar background and she's able to get out here on this tennis scene and do very well. I should be able to try to emulate that. So I never obviously was at the same level of Katrina Adams. She went on to have obviously a very good pro career and NCAA champion. And I always said my goal was to be 15% of Katrina Adams, but she definitely wasn't a role model, but she was a trailblazer. And I definitely followed in a little bit of that draft that she created as a young kid coming from the west side of Chicago in tennis. So most certainly looked up to her, even though I just knew her from afar more so. But I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'd say that the other role models Scott Soloway, who worked at the McFetrich Sports Center. He was the person that was running the junior development program there, and my aunt played there socially, so I started playing in that program, and Scott was really instrumental in learning the work ethic and doing two-on-ones and hitting on the ball machine and instilling all of that. So I most certainly had a lot of work ethic from what I learned from Scott back in those days. He and I have a famous story where he said the kids today are just not consistent enough. So I had a hitting lesson with him one day, and he came out and he didn't bring the cart. He didn't bring the basket. He just cracked one can of balls, put them in his hand. He looked at me and he said, three balls. And I said, okay, what does that mean? He says, the moment these three balls end, our lesson is over. So we're keeping the ball going for an entire hour, and we're only going to have three rallies.
Mm. Wow. Great story.
Yeah, it's a true story. So the first rally, I missed after 47 balls. The second rally, I missed after 9 balls. And then the third rally, I went 1,455 balls. Oh. And the lesson got to 54 minutes after the hour. And then I had to run sprints for the last 6 minutes because I couldn't, because I was the one that missed all three times.
No, that's a great story.
He never missed.
With high school tennis in parts of the country, I'm disappointed that it's faded away. It used to be everybody played high school tennis. So in addition to junior tennis, did you play high school tennis?
I did play high school tennis. I was fortunate. Kenwood Academy was the school that I went to for high school. And at Kenwood Academy, we were really just an anomaly that there were several African-American tennis players that were all playing and all ranked in the Western and were all training at this Hyde Park Athletic Club. And so Jimmy Hurd and John Devine and David Bryant, and you know, these are blasts from the past names that many might wouldn't know, but all these guys were playing the tournaments, playing the circuit. Their mothers were great. Their mothers were all pitching in and giving us rides to places. And so it was a community that I was part of, which was different than the McFetrich community on the south side where I was living. And a guy by the name of Chris Scott, who's a Hall of Fame coach that had a very distinct way that he taught the backhand called the recoil method. Chris Scott was running a program with a guy named Joe White, who was on the south side of Chicago. So there were these like legendary icon guys from the black tennis community. And I came up underneath the programming that a lot of these guys had. And so with Katrina Adams and Wendy Mitchell, Lisa Kanazi, there were so many. You'd never seen 15, 20 African-American kids all playing tennis on a bank of 5 courts. They were all serious. So it was really a unique time. And obviously I was able to quickly pick it up. The high school tennis was very good. We had a couple guys that were older, Scott Harrison and Malcolm Avon. They were like bigger than life at that time. And they took me under my wing as a young guy and showed me the ropes. And eventually after a couple of years, I became the number one player and captain. But yeah, it was just lightning in a bottle being fortunate enough to come through at that time and have those opportunities and have that ecosystem that was so prevalent.
Were the when you played high school tennis, is boys in the spring?
That's correct.
So you played in some bad weather. That'll build character.
Absolutely. And on our high school courts, I just our home high school courts, I didn't lose matches over there.
And then so your aunt Ida had a big role. How about your parents? Were they tennis players or former athletes? What was their role in your upbringing in tennis?
My mom was a cheerleader. My dad played basketball. They were not involved in the tennis. They were obviously working. I grew up with my mom and my stepdad, actually. But my mom has only been to tennis 3 times in my entire career. She watched one junior match in a national tournament in St. Louis. She watched one high school match at a weekend invitational, and she watched me play one match in college. And then the fourth time my mom came to anything tennis in my entire life was when I got inducted into the USPTA Hall of Fame in 2017 at the Cincinnati Masters Series event. So my mom's only been to tennis four times. Here recently, as an adult now, I've been doing a fundraiser every November, and my mom has been doing some catering and helping. So she's come to tennis once a year, the Sunday before Thanksgiving now, a few more times. But ultimately, through my playing career, she only saw me play three times. So my aunt was the de facto tennis mother, and my dad only saw me play once. So between both parents, only four actual times their eyes were on me on a tennis court in my entire life. So I was driving the passion. I was my aunt, it gave me the exposure, and then I fueled the motivation.
It's interesting. Times have changed where, I mean, I know some parents, they don't miss a practice, and I know everything's circumstantial. I mean, you know, I guess the times have changed where it's a 180. It's completely different take. Tennis, I've always thought of Chicago as a great tennis town. Alan Schwartz, Tennis Corporation of America. I worked for that company for two years. With Chicago, though, the weather, tell us a little bit about, you know, getting indoor court time, and you know, did you play most of the winter growing up, or you're really playing some bad weather, shoveling snow, that type of story?
Well, yeah, you most certainly played in some cold temperatures and had to deal with all of that. That's just par for the course. But indoor court time, yeah, we play, but I would play at McFetridge. I'd go to 6:45 a.m. on a Saturday morning and play for a few hours. I would play late at night. I just play when there was opportunity. One of the nice things about the High Park Athletic Club is that if you had a certain membership, they had junior walk on. That was a great, great thing. So if you got out of school at 2:45, you could hit from 3 to 4 before, you know, the programs or the things got busy. So I definitely was a court rat and took advantage of some of those relationships. But the majority of my time was spent between High Park Athletic Club and McFetridge. And I did play when I got older and I got better, I did play in the Super Excellence program, which was at Midtown. And Stanley, you mentioned Alan Schwartz, obviously very, very sad that he's no longer with us. He was a wonderful man to me, and was great to me in the beginning of my tennis career, and was great to me at the end of my tennis career. In my tennis career, when I got to be one of the best players in that program, Alan made a phone call, pulled some strings, and sent the best 8 boys from Chicago out of the Super Excellence program. And we went down to Jamaica and stayed in villas for an entire week and played all the top national Jamaican juniors. And so he just, with a phone call, created an opportunity like that for us. It didn't cost us a dime, and went down there with $150 worth of spending money. I didn't know there was a conversion rate. So 6 to 1, I was walking around with $900 at age 16 in Jamaica, the chaperone. So yeah, it's crazy, crazy times, but what an experience. First time that I was able to go, besides going to Niagara Falls, this is the first time I've been out of the country, and I had an opportunity to do that because of what Alan Schwartz provided. So just a great man, and helped me a lot and mentored me a lot in the tail end of my career, in terms of when he was the USTA president and et cetera. So I have always had a great reverence for him, and I'm very, very sorry that he's no longer with us.
No, I appreciate those comments. I had a chance to meet him many times. I know, like yourself, he's in a number of Hall of Fames. So your progression, tell us about, I'm interested to hear more about DePaul, your scholarship athlete, and your coach at DePaul. When you start so with that,
I was because I was an athlete and I was hungry. No disrespect to the tennis ecosystem, but if you get a kid that is athletic and motivated, sometimes they can pass up some of the kids that have been doing it for years and years and years. And I was that kid. I improved very quickly, and lost my very first match 6-0, 6-0, and the same guy that I lost to, I beat 3 years later. So what ended up happening was tennis started opening up a little bit at the end of my GA career. I was a unique one in that I graduated high school at 16. So I wasn't able to have even a full, you know, 5 years starting at 13 in the tournaments. I couldn't even get to a full 18 before college. I was at 16 and a half starting college at DePaul in the fall of 1985. So I was 16 and maybe 7 or 8 months. So I had a very small window to prove things, and it was difficult. There were some people that knew me and saw me, and so I had some possibilities to go to some schools. But DePaul, luckily, George Lott, you know, got wind of me because of, obviously, Midtown and Allen. And DePaul was practicing in Midtown at the time, and so he was able to see what was going on. And I ended up, and in those tournaments, I couldn't qualify for Kalamazoo. I'd lose in the back. I couldn't get through the top group of guys who were so strong back in those days. It was just, but I was a good, strong sectional junior that was starting to break in and play. They had a bunch of at-large national tournaments that were starting at that point. And if you played X amount of those, you could get on the national ranking. Not just being in Kalamazoo, they had a couple of different ways you could get, you know, ranked sectionally and nationally. And so I was jumping through those hoops and getting those exposures, and very thankful to go to DePaul on a full scholarship. And George Lott, who was the coach there, Hall of Fame legend guy, was, you know, late, you know, he was already in the 70s at that time being a college coach. So it's difficult for him, but he just had such a wealth of knowledge and cared so much about us, and really was much more concerned about us being on time and being good men and bringing our gifts to the host for a party, graduating on time, having good table manners. Like he was so old school on so many things, and a lot of the guys just didn't realize it. I picked it up quickly and I bought in, but some of the other guys were just like, what's he talking about? And I would give him rides to his bridge games. I would have almost like the book Tuesday with Maury. I would have lunch with him once a week just to pick his brain. So I definitely benefited from having someone that was a Kalamazoo champion, an NCAA champion, and a Davis Cup player, number two in the world, and Grand Slam champion as a coach, and especially with me being so young to help me in that formative period. But he didn't understand the way tennis was going. He felt that tennis only made sense if the baseline connected to the net. So players that would just play the baseline and never come to the net but to shake hands, he would always say, I don't understand you guys playing all these ground shots. We call them ground shots, not ground strokes. But he enjoyed my play. But obviously, going back to my hybrid model, I was coming in like McEnroe and taking balls on the rise and using the topspin to set up my net game. So I was playing what he considered tennis that made sense. And so after my freshman year playing six, sophomore year, he moved me up to three, and I hadn't beaten the other guys on the team, and it caused some dissension because some guys really felt that I was sucking up to coach, taking them to lunch and hanging out with him, and that's how I got my lineup bump. But he just felt that I was playing a better brand of tennis. And I remember that like yesterday, some guys were upset a little bit, but I started the season 11-0, got off to a great start and didn't look back, and everybody kind of shut up after that. But he definitely saw something in me, and it was just a different mentality. He really was engaged and coached the doubles. The singles, he had to kind of let most of the guys do things on their own because he couldn't relate. So he would watch me and enjoy me more. But some of our number one player, Chris Kannenberg, who's the captain, Chris served in volley even on first and second serve. So he obviously enjoyed watching Chris, but it was an interesting time for sure. And just recently there was an actual court dedication at XS Tennis in Chicago here where Kamal Murray is. And one of the courts is now named after our coach. And that just happened on Sunday, February 25th. So it's very nice to see that there was some commemoration for him, because the courts that we played on were clay courts. And that was kind of a distinct advantage, and the NCAA had to rule that out. We would play matches, and one of my best wins in college was playing a guy that was a Russian guy that was ranked in the ITA rankings, and he came and he just goes, wait a minute, clay courts, I didn't realize that our home courts were clay. So he was very upset to find that out, and I ended up getting a great win that maybe I wouldn't have gotten under normal circumstances. But those, that same land where we played our college tennis now is a parking lot that's generating, you know, $1 million a year for DePaul University. So we, at this point, don't have an actual outdoor facility for that team. And they play a lot of away matches and they play some indoor matches. And so that's just one of the dynamics of big city real estate. I was recently at the Columbia University New Courts in New York, which is an amazing facility, but it cost them $52 million to do that in Manhattan. So, so it gives you an idea of why things happen and big business and all. But the truth is, yeah, the courts that I play college on, when I drive down Sheffield, I no longer see those. I see a parking lot.
I took some notes on George Lott very quickly. 1964, he's placed in the International Tennis Hall of Fame in doubles, French in 1931, Wimbledon 31, 34, US Open 28, 29, 30, 34. Mixed 31, U.S. Open 28, 29, 30, 33, 34. Yeah, he won with three different partners. He wrote a book. I have, I think, 800-plus tennis books. I don't have a copy of his How to Play Winning Doubles. Could you comment on that, his doubles a little bit more?
Yes, extremely. I didn't read the entire book. I most certainly read excerpts of it. But the way he coached doubles was a lot about scheming and where to stand. And one of the things I distinctly remember was he told me I was selling too hard with my move on faking. And he gave me a little trick on how to get a lob. If I was a service partner and I wanted to draw a lob to myself, he told me that I needed to stand a good 3.5 feet back from the net, farther back than I normally would, and act a little bit nonchalant, act like I almost was being just indifferent. And then right as my server throws his toss up, give a hard split step forward as my server is throwing the toss up, and then the receiver picks that up in his eye and he sees my weight going forward, and right away that naturally would make them consider lobbing me. And then I would just turn my shoulders and go back and snap the overhead. And so he just gave you so many little hidden gems like that. So I really, he talked about the making sure not to stand too far wide when you're serving, which is long before people were doing all the eye formations and things. He just felt like if you were a good volleyer, you could cover a lot more space with your outside volley. So he wanted you standing a little bit more, like almost halfway between the singles and the doubles line, because it just gave you more locations in the box, more pitches that you could pitch, and to keep your partner involved in getting touches. So if you're having to hit a majority of your first volleys, then you're not doing a good job of your serving. So many just schematic and team and philosophies that he gave. And he really coached the doubles hard, and the singles he kind of allowed us to be ourselves because he realized that the game was passing him by and that he couldn't necessarily relate to how maybe a Yannick Sinner or a Rublev might play right now.
With YouTube, you already alluded to this, where he's a poker player, bridge player. There's one clip where he says, tennis is like playing bridge. You need to set players up with premeditated moves. He actually played doubles with Les Stofan. I taught tennis with Les Stofan Jr. at the Vic Braden Tennis College. And Les Stofan at the time had the best serve in tennis in the 1930s. And it was the sculptor who created the trophy look, where he wanted, back in the day, everybody played baseball, and Les Stofan, Braden, you saw his story, he would turn like a baseball pitcher, but he really, the artist wanted to have the elbow down, the left arm way up. You see that type of photo in old yearbooks of a quarterback, how they put their arm in the football and the throwing position, and they have their arm pointing straight out where there's no shoulder rotation. But there's also a clip of him playing tennis with Frank Parker from Chicago. It was in the top 10, 17 times he was top 10 in the world. But how did he hit the ball? When you, I mean, he coached till he was till his deathbed, right? He stayed right there with tennis until he passed away.
He did. He hit the ball. He had a little bit too much belly, so he would just feed. But yeah, he was just pretty classical Eastern swing.
But there's a clip of him playing doubles he has a little bit of a pot belly, but it looked like he had a very short, compact forehand, and but old school. He could definitely come forward, though, huh?
Yeah, that was the way to play. That's what he believed in, most certainly.
Of course, back in his day, with three of the four majors on grass and players wearing spikes, they didn't want the ball to bounce, and playing with wooden rackets. He said, I saw this on a clip as well. He said, I slept like a baby. I lost in four close sets to Ellsworth Vines for the national title, singles national title. Was he a storyteller as well about the old days?
Yeah, he told some hilarious stories. He told me one story about his first racket endorsement. He told me that he was going to Davis Cup, and you know, they weren't flying back then. They caught like a boat going across. And he says that he had tried out these new rackets and he didn't like them. So he went over and still played with his old rackets, and he just threw the rackets overboard into the ocean. Some shark probably had them for lunch. But I think that was probably, I'm not sure if that was the beginning of someone trying to come up with something different than wood or not, but yeah, he did not take to the new racket. So he just said that they weren't great. He didn't like them, but yeah, he wasn't having it with those rackets. He threw them overboard on a Davis Cup trip, but he is,
that's funny.
Yeah. Just a guy that always, he held court, had a lot of stories. And I was, for whatever reason, just revering all of that history and things. I've always been a bit of a sports guy, and so I have a lot of respect, but I also enjoy the storytelling and the learning. So I think I hung out with him, like I said, probably a little bit more than some of the other guys did, because I was kind of just sponging all of the different things that were, some of the things were not even tennis related, right? So,
well, back in the day with the amateur tennis, as you would know, tennis history, being a historian, they 62 Labor wins four majors, Grand Slam, then 69. But when they were amateurs, the players, shamateurism, they would get as many like 100 rackets, and they would sell those rackets. When people used to win Wimbledon, what's the name of the famous place where they shop in London?
Oxford Street.
But the name of the store, Harrods. Yeah. Harrods. When Wimbledon, you get $28 pound gift certificate at Harrods. With, but how did you guys do as a team? How did Paul do during your 4 years?
I'd say sophomore year, we were pretty good. That was the best year. But it was, we'd go 17-9. We would beat a bunch of smaller, you know, mid-major type of schools. And we would play a few top schools would play us because the coaches just wanted to meet George and hang out with him.
Well, that's funny.
So, yeah. We wouldn't have a right to play Northwestern, have a right to play Notre Dame or some of those schools, but Paul Torricelli or Bobby Bayless or some of those coaches would want to hang out with George.
That makes sense.
So they would, you know, most teams would put a weaker school on their schedule in the beginning of the year, this side and the other. So yeah, we definitely, now back in those days, Notre Dame and DePaul were both major independents. We weren't part of conferences, so it was a lot harder. George was getting up there in the years, so I don't think he would be just spending so much time chasing down which match we could get to try to move the ranking up and, you know, all the calculus that everybody deals with now. But yeah, I'd say sophomore. We picked up a foreign guy, Voschek, and then Chris Cannenberg and Mark Matuska, myself, Vince Baltimore. I'd say the sophomore year was our best year.
Was he on top of it as far as you guys being student athletes and how you were doing in the classroom?
Like I said before, how you doing in the classroom, your table manners, how you respected the department, like all of those things were as important as your four.
Oh, that's great. And what did you study at DePaul?
I was kind of a mixed bag, pre-law guy, poli-sci, economics, communications, and English. And so it was to set up a situation to ultimately be a lawyer at the end.
And when did you, you started coaching, you're probably coaching from the get-go, but when did you make that a career move?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I was done playing in 89, I wanted to go out because I was started late and had such a short career. I wanted to go play some more. I still loved it. I wanted to compete. Went and tried to, just go on the future qualies and things like that and just get my butt kicked. Back in those days, future qualies were 256 draws. You had to win four rounds just to get into the main, and it was amazing how deep, you'd have to go to Decatur and Joplin and Lawrenceville, Kansas, and all these different places. And so I went out and was playing. I was playing normal grand, men's opens, and they had a different circuit of prize money tournaments. There was a lot of great tennis out there. And a lot of these small money tournaments that could keep players going that just aren't there now. Obviously UTR is trying to do that a little bit now. But a year and a half of playing, got my butt kicked, realized I wasn't going to be able to make money. And then, my mom was like, what are you going to do? And so obviously I wanted to try to, take an LSAT and connect with some of the people I knew and see if the law thing could be a possibility. And at the same time, I was doing a little tennis too, because I was interested about the tennis and, not interested about tennis, but just keeping tennis in my life because it had been part of my life for so long. And it just was a complete fluke. I was working at McFetcher Sports Center, making $8.96 an hour, and realized, oh my gosh, I'm actually really good at coaching. I had no idea. So I had the epiphany there, and then took the USPTA exam in 1991, became certified, and went after it. And my first two students from the Park District who were playing, I'm saying they were, back then it was $8 for a non-primetime court and having a lesson. And so my first female student that was good was a girl named Rajasri Kurvilla, a little Indian girl that went to Lane Tech, two sisters, Tom Kurvilla, tennis dad, and she went on to win the Midwest Close. She won the Westerns, beating Matt Coe, who was a Jack Sharp kid, Muriel Verbin, who was a top girl, and Laura Granville, who was John Trump's girl. So me and a little girl with no money from the city of Chicago, from the Park District at $8 a court, won the Midwest Championship, and right then a coaching star was born.
No, that's great. Those are two names, Jack Sharp and John Trump. Who was mentoring you when you first started coaching?
Well, I worked for Scott Sullivan, so Scott was mentoring me. I would say my entire high school, a guy named John Chemaine, who played college tennis at Brandeis and owned a computer store at University, in Hyde Park. And he had a bunch of us young high school kids working and selling IBM-compatible computers to the Graduate School of Business for University of Chicago. And John played tennis in college, would take us out and play, and taught us how to drive and took us to the U.S. Open for the first time. And so John was very instrumental. Obviously Scott. And then coaching-wise, I just went out there and got after it. I was a little bit of a young guy with some bravado, and I was a little bit of a hot shot. So I think that the powers that be were a little threatened by me. And I think that as my students started doing well and I started just doing everything I could, I would call up the other clubs and say, who are your best A players? I'll meet you at your club I'll bring you $200, get some pizzas, let my best A play your best A. Let's see what happens. I was challenging other clubs and saying, let's go, let's get a match. And so that was what I was doing with these little kids that I had from the inner city. And we started beating all these suburban clubs and people going, what's going on here?
Now, that's a fantastic story. I think that's a problem today is a lot of kids are programmed out and they don't play enough sets. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, they struggle with that. A lot of kids now have to play the tournament to get the sets in. I run a program on Sunday nights where I have four courts that are just have a revolving coach and they have brand new balls. And when you go over there, you know what you're doing. Now, on the other side, I still have some other, doubles or games or tactics and things going on. But when you go over there, you know you're going to play a match and out there for 2.5-3 hours, and everybody's going to go over there for a while. So I'm trying to have that meet this Sunday night. So I'm trying to make sure that they're doing that. But I would say now the programs are more designed to be point playing programs and not match playing programs. So I do all kinds of things. I rent out Northwestern every summer for a day, pay the fee, pay the insurance, and I run three college matches, three duels in a row. Some older girls, some older boys, and some younger kids. And I just, hey, let's go. We're getting some shirts. You're playing number three doubles. You're playing number four singles, on-court coaching. So I'm constantly trying to do these things, add these extra components. I have a program on March 16th called Competition Training Center where I'll have 16 to 20 kids for 4.5 hours and they're going to play matches. So I'm programming it, but I'm most certainly rare.
And do you find that the pros support that? Do they support the having, say you're not actually coaching the players, but the other coaches send their players to play matches?
Yeah, there are some coaches that won't send them, but at least at this point, I've created a niche where I have good practice. People know that there's going to be substance, and I'm just not in the business of trying to steal everybody's students. I'm working a boutique operation. I'm 55 years old. I can't coach every kid, so I'm not. It's just nice to have a bunch of kids battling together, and it's great. Particularly if you can have an outreach program on the weekend where some kids that aren't normally part of your Monday through Thursday sphere of influence can come and take part and rub elbows, and you can get some variety for your own students. So yeah, I keep up with it, and I've been getting decent support from other clubs. Well, sometimes it's hard because if they're not doing a great job with their program and their product, and I am, then their kids and parents may go, gosh, we should be going over here. So they may not want that exposure, because if you don't know that the grass is green on the other side, you just don't know what you don't know.
Well, yeah, parents beware. I think some coaches can be too or overly possessive, and they will limit their players of opportunities, the ones that you're describing. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I call it a variety day. I may send some kids to other places on a variety day, and I put that on the schedule. But what I found is that sometimes I've supported some other programs and my students come back and go, yeah, I didn't like it that much. I'll stay here. And I'll say, okay. So that affirms that they really are enjoying what they're getting at my place. But yeah, I work very hard at the dynamics of practice and trying to make sure that the drills and everything that we're practicing is pertinent. And I keep my eyes on pro tennis, college tennis, and junior tennis all the time. So I always have somebody under 10 years old that I'm coaching individually. And I'm always watching from the pros through college, through juniors, all the way down.
I like the comment you made on point play versus match play, that whatever people call it, move up the river, down the river. That's just not the same as playing sets and playing matches. Well, you're a veteran coach now. I met you in the 90s. My recollection is Craig Tiley, he was at the University of Illinois. He was with us for 7 years prior to that. He sent a young Mark Bay to University Liggett, home of Aaron Crickstein, a private school in Grosse Pointe. What are your recollections of that long weekend?
My Steve Smith experience?
The initial one, yeah. I mean, I know I've run into you here, there, and everywhere. national tournaments and NCAA tournaments, but over the years, over the decades now, but go ahead.
I was amazed at how much content you had. I just didn't know. And you were very concerned about video long before people were really locked into video. So just the depth and the how broad and extensive your knowledge base was, and how intricate you were with the video and how particular you were, and how you had your method. Now, there's a lot of methods. There's a lot of ways to skin cats. And I definitely would raise my hand and refute and be a little bit of a doubting Thomas while I was in that class for you, but all in respect of you and what you were doing. And I think our biggest arguments were the stylistic, what was art versus what was science. I think that really kind of stems out to me. And then I remember our running joke about Connor and Dennis Nivola, who was my young guy at that time. And
I think many years later, but Connor, he played one of your students, Evan King. We were in three sets. Evan won. I saw him play later, I believe, definitely in college and maybe in the pros playing doubles against each other. But
no, there's no doubt. No, what happened was I was questioning some of the early preparation, just the dynamics on the forehand that you were teaching Connor. I thought it was a little small. I thought it was a little limiting with the non-dominant hand. And I said, you know, if the guy can really generate racket at speed, you got to give him more freedom. And I was kind of, I thought I was a little cutting edge on that at the time, because there was a lot of concern about catching the racket and decelerating with the racket in the non-dominant hand. And then you just say, well, no, we'll see in a few years. And then Dennis beat Connor at Kalamazoo. And then you said, well, Mark, I guess you're right. You came up to me and said that. I'll never forget that. It's because you remember from all those years ago. But then I came up to you later at a tournament and I said, well, Connor's world ranking Trump Dennis's, so I guess you were right.
So actually, Dennis, he spent a little time. Tennis world is so small, all the different connections. But he spent a little time really staying with us. But when he did stay with us, you know, he got an invite to train at Saddlebrook. Isner was really the go-to guy. I remember staying to Dennis. He goes, yeah, I think I'm really doing well against John. You know, and he's, you know, at that time, maybe Isner was 20 in the world. And I said, well, explain the drills to me. It was like rally four and played out. I go, well, there's something missing if John's not starting the point with a serve. But I remember him. I remember him being so fit. I was ran a national tournament. He played Ryan Kim in the final. Ryan played at Princeton. And these guys were warriors from the baseline. But Dennis was way ahead of the curve. I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, as far as fitness, though.
Well, he was just fast twitch, hand eye, incredible vision. I met him at 9. His parents were moving from out east to Chicago. And they had seen somewhere that I'd won a coaching award, so they came and had an evaluation with me. And I started with Dennis, and 3 years later, he was national champion. So he was number one in the country in 12s, 16s, and 18s. He was number one 3 different times. Got up to around 300 and was running for a drop shot down in Texas at a challenger and tore ligaments in his thumb and was never the same after that. When he came back with his 8 protected tournaments, he put up 5 zeros, including one match in Vegas, up 5-2 in the third on TFO. He just could never get it back.
Yeah. I ran into him. He was working as a sparring partner in Orlando not too many years ago. You must know his brother. I've only met his brother via telephone, but he was the coach at South Carolina when one of our students, Lissa Kimmel, who's now a pickleball star. I understand he's a really funny guy. Did you coach him too?
He was in the program. I didn't coach him privately, but he was part of the program. And now he has a top 40 program at SMU on the women's side. He's doing outstanding. Now, the Bolos are great people.
I tell you a funny story. I'm a big Rajiv Ram fan. I just love to watch the guy play. I mean, back when he played singles, because talk about old school. I mean, I remember writing reports for Tylee because Tylee couldn't be at matches. And somebody would hit a high arcing moon ball and he'd play an approach volley approach. I mean, he'd come in and off the ball, like the other guys on the baseline. And So obviously I was just going forward, but we were at the National 14s. This comes back to having someone, you know, really look mechanical. You know, we tease, well, your players look mechanical. Yeah, we're working on mechanics. And I can tell people that, well, I've fed balls to Rajiv Ram, never coached him for a second, but I had a kid by the name of Blake Wilmarth, and he went on and played at Colgate. And at one time, you know, the rankings go, not to discredit him, but he was ranked one, I think it was in the 14s. And, you know, we just saw each other and who you're with. And, but, you know, Rahm won the tournament going away. I mean, it was almost like he had the same game then that he does now. I mean, just copying Sampras. You know all these guys and you spent so much time with Rajiv Rahm. But so you said to me, you know, we're watching Blake Wilmarth. You were just talking to tennis like coaches do, and we're looking across the courts and go, I can't stand watching that kid play. And then you said to me, who are you with? And I said, Ryland Harden, that kid that you can't stand watching play. But, you know, one thing about Blake, last I heard, he's a lawyer. I'm sure he's a very successful lawyer. But he made the lineup as a freshman at Colgate. He didn't make the lineup as a sophomore. And, that, you know, I get on the phone and read people the Riot Act. But, yeah, that you know, that's one thing that we certainly take. Someone said to us one time, we don't microwave tennis. We go very, very slow. And he had a very good fundamental base. But what's your recollection of Rajiv Rahm at 14? It was at the tennis club of Fort Lauderdale.
I met him at 12, and he was from actually Wisconsin. So he was a cheesehead first, and he moved to Indianapolis at 12. So second year 12, he's number one in the Westerns, and he moved to Indianapolis and started working with Mark Waltmore there. And then eventually became obviously working with Brian Smith, and they've continued on, and now Brian is even with him right now at Indian Wells. So I just couldn't believe with modeling how someone could be that close, but his intricacies with the elbow on the forehand and the foot on the serve and the feel on the volleys, he was as close to a Sampras prototype as I've ever seen. And I could imitate a lot. When I said I was imitating, I had those models, I could imitate McEnroe's serve as a right-handed, you know, mirror image version and Connors. But I was a ball boy back when I was younger. So Chicago had a bunch of stops on the Virginia Slims Tour and the Ameritech Professional Men's Tour. So I was always a ball boy for all those professional tournaments. And so I just sat there in the corner watching Boris Becker serve, watching Connors return, watching Johnny Mac volley, watching Navratilova cut the court off, watching Chris Evert's concentration. So I picked up so much from that. I think that arguably being a ball boy was better than having 100 private lessons. My family didn't have the money, so I couldn't have it. And no one ever taught me how to serve. I was never given a private lesson on how to serve in my life. Being a baseball and a basketball player, I brought the athleticism to the courts. My aunt gave me a bag of balls from the grocery store and said, go down to the end and practice your serve.
I remember, our listeners, first of all, Rajiv Rahm, modeling is a great way to describe that with Sampras. They call him Rompras. One of the guys that I've spent some time with, you would know, Mike Costa, Midwesterner, he played for Ty Lee. He was on the team as they were building up to win nationals. I think it was a year after he graduated, but he says about Rajiv Rahm, he yawns in between volleys. You know, he's played some with Austin Krajicek. I know they won at least one title in Russia. Then he played several years with Raven Klassen. So he's played with some people that I've trained. But the old tennis club of Fort Lauderdale. But he, you know, there was a kid for the parents listening is that he could take a ball out of the air. And I just still coming back to George Lott. I think what Dick Gould said, I don't care how you get there, but you get there at least twice a game, you know, then you have to think about the surface. Refer getting to the net, Matt Clore, who's spent a lot of years with us. He was with Mackenzie McDonald and Federer basically said the same thing. Of course it was about grass. I don't care how you get there, but you get there twice a game but I used to hang out there. There was a guy named Oscar Wagner who's pretty well known for tennis teaching.
Of course
there was I had a van and I had all these audio tapes, and someone said with someone who works for Oscar Wagner said, Oscar has never heard of my name, third person, Steve Smith. And when you have a name like Steve Smith, a lot of people haven't heard of you. So from a coaching standpoint, did you ever think about leaving Chicago? I mean, you've been in Chicago. You're loyal. I was asking you before we got on the air about Chris Chelios. They just honored him, just put his number up in the rafters for the Chicago Blackhawks. So, I mean, I think so many people are like, well, I want to go to California. I want to go to Florida. But you've been loyal to Chicago. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I'm happy to comment on that. I was told early on as a coach that the best coaches don't bounce around. They go to a place, they grow roots, and they bear fruit. I was told that a long time ago. And obviously, I got my start in McFetcher Sports Center for 4 years. And then I was offered a deal to work with Steve Wild out in Libertyville. And I was there for 17 years and pretty much made a big name for myself in the sport. I also had a great start at McFetcher's with a kid named Connor Murnion, who was part of the Illinois team as well, Rams team. And then ultimately, that Radistry Kerrville young lady and several others. So I started out hot in those first 4 years, and then I really picked up steam working under Steve Wild for 17 years at Libertyville. And then now, and since 2011, I've been in my current location, Glenview Tennis Club. So I only worked at three places, and one for 17 and another for 12. So, you've got to stick to a place, and you've got to take the card hands that you've been dealt, and then you've got to do the best you can with that. And so I'm not a fan of LeBron and super teams and let's get all these guys so we can win a title. I have much more respect for the Milwaukee Bucks winning and, the Bulls winning who they had. So I try to take the, I think Chicago still has enough affluence and enough talent pool. And I think that the Midwest upbringing is important. I think that the Florida Academy stuff, and again, some of the Florida coaches are some of my best friends in the business, but I just think that the model is a little, it's just a little skewed. There's too much concern for the superstar high-ranked player. Everything is about them, and they give them free deals and a little bit too much, and then those kids don't have that same love and care for the program. And then whenever there's a sweeter deal around the corner, they leave, and you have all these other people paying all this money to try to be around this superstar kid. And I've just never subscribed to that model. So I'm one of the few people in tennis that's been able to work a participation driven model in the business for 33 years and have it actually sustainable. So if I'm a kid who's top five in the nation and that kid wants to come to my program right now, one day a week, he's not getting the class for free. He's not even getting the class at the same price as my other students. He's actually paying a premium to come and come less and to walk into the nightclub at 11:45 on Saturday night when it's jumping and the DJ's going and the place is back. So I've been able to do that where most of the time it's all in junior tennis about placating the parent or the child that's the highest ranked player. And I've always been more focused on the common denominator. How good is my average player? And do I have a daily essential product of kids going off to college and becoming great people? If I'm doing that well, then the business should flourish.
No, you communicate that point so well. The bop and shop and get tennis academies, people do their homework. People, it's like musical chairs. They go from, one year at one academy and the next year at the next academy. And I do obviously think that people have to travel for tournaments, but not necessarily. The grass is not greener on the other side. As I said earlier, the Midwest, it's a fact that it produced more players before people were, just having to leave their backyard. It's like, well, it's the grass is greener on the other side. Tell us about Steve Wild. Did you work with Linda Harvey Wild when she was playing too?
Most certainly. I have some of the most hilarious stories with Steve, but I'll keep it simple. Steve is a visionary guy. Steve deserves a lot of credit. I know in the King Richard movie, they talk a lot about the open stance and how Richard Williams was big on open stance. I think Steve Wild was a bit of an open stance pioneer. So Steve deserves a lot more credit than he gets in the market for that. and Robbie Weiss and Linda and some of his proteges that were top 50 in the world were very good at that. So Robbie was an NCAA champion at Pepperdine and was top 50 in the world. Beat Mendel and Edberg and Becker. And Linda was top 25 in the world herself. And so Steve had already kind of put a blueprint out there. I still had my own ideas. He let me run the junior program the way I wanted to, so I had that autonomy. But yeah, as a young coach for him, I was a hitting partner for Linda at the U.S. Open multiple times. And one, and a funny story, it's a funny story, but Linda was getting ready to play Lindsay Davenport in Art Louis Armstrong Stadium. They didn't have Ash back then. And Steve felt that that day, the tactics should have been that Linda would play through Lindsay's forehand and get Lindsay off balance that way. I felt like that would be a little bit riskier because I felt Linda's forehand, if it was on, was very good, but she could be a little bit more turbulent. I thought her backhand was just really, really good. Now, Lindsay's backhand was amazing too, but I thought, okay, Linda's, you know, just as young, fast, quick, and can handle that pace and that rally. So I like the match being set up on the left side of the court. Steve likes it being set up on the right side of the court, but I'm the flunky, you know, I'm the hitting partner. I don't have anything. So Steve's running all these drills, practicing with Linda and working on the right side and taking balls out of the air. And I'm just sitting there picking up balls and, you know, just doing my assistant job, right? And before a big match, Steve's drinking too many Diet Cokes and he had to go to the bathroom. And if you know, in the old Armstrong, it was a long walk to get to the bathroom from the court. So as we're waiting for him to come back, I say, Linda, you know, just in case this other pattern doesn't work for a fallback, just hit a couple on the left side. Why don't we just groove a couple backhand to backhand? Because I think you could beat her there too. So I didn't really rock the boat, but I just kind of said, hey, this might be a thought. And fast forward, Linda Wild went 6-0 in the third over Davenport and the round of 16 in the U.S. Open to make it to the quarters. And after the match, she comes over and Linda gives me a high five and smiles. And it's kind of a funny story because obviously Steve wasn't privy to the little input there from that day. But yeah, it was fun. And I had a bunch of those little instances where I didn't necessarily, I was Luke Skywalker and he was Yoda, and I didn't necessarily agree with all of the, you know, things, but I thought Steve represented, you know, he wanted excellence. And we had staff meetings. He brought coaches in to train us from whoever, top coaches to come, Louis Cahier or whoever it was that was out there that was a good coach. He brought them in. He was okay with me bringing top coaches in. I used to run that event that you came to, that World, you know, National Junior Tennis Conference for 14 years. Steve was big on mission statement, being fair, honest, and consistent with customers. I learned a great deal from Steve on the business side and on the management side. So obviously a lot to thank Steve for.
And it doesn't... Steve, I mean, with Linda, they have, he had Steve's grandson or her son, who's a really good player, right?
He's very good. He won Eddie Herr. He's one of the best 16-year-olds in the world. And he is now approaching the top 100 in ITF juniors in the world at 16. So they've had a bunch of grandkids that have played, but he's the one that's become the star and most certainly is going to have a very strong career, college pros, whatever he chooses to do. So yeah, Jack Secord is his name. He's very good.
With I went to Libertyville more than once, but when Paul McDonald was the head coach under Steve Wild, and then Paul left, but there was I ran this program where you get a college degree, and there was two or three guys on staff, but then they Steve hired someone. I guess I went in as the arbitrator, and I had all these videos with Oscar Wagner. And yeah, Oscar does a lot of great things. You can learn from everyone. But I remember I got snowed in. It was there an extra day. And it was, I come in with the Braden science and said, well, let's follow the science. And anyway, it was, there were some things just, which is, it's my father used to say that the world would be a boring place if everybody agreed on everything. But there were some points that, I just went, because it was really why I was brought in is that Steve had hired a new director or head coach, and he was having problems with the staff that Paul had assembled. But he was an understudy of Alan Schwartz. I remember he used to say so many positive things about Alan Schwartz, Steve Wild.
Yeah, Alan was a mentor for Steve on the business side.
Yeah.
Buying clubs, running clubs,
So all these years, I mean, touch upon philosophy. I know we could talk to you forever. What are some principles that you would want to share with, you know, young coaches that are listening, even parents, players?
I'm an all-court coach. So I really believe strongly in the all-court model. I've always been that guy. I try to give players a technical understanding of how to hit and then give them a lot of performing and applying and repeating. And then immediately, as soon as I can, put them in situations where they have to pressure perform, because pressure performance is everything. And so I'm not John Wooden, but I do have my own pyramid. And my pyramid contains fun at the base, desire and dreams on the next rung, and then tactical instincts. Because sometimes kids want to do the right thing, but they don't have the size of the game yet to do them. And they shouldn't be discouraged. And technical foundations. A lot of times people talk technical foundation, that's all they talk. And to me, there's so many other facets at play. And then I'm big on playing experiences and match count, self-evaluation, something I call independence, responsibility, and accountability. If I tell a top player to go hit their serve for 25 minutes or go on the ball machine and give me 200 quality reps off their backhand lesson, I expect that to be done. And then physical development, dealing with adversity, and then pressure performance at the top of the pyramid. That's my, the Mark Bay pyramid of tennis success. And the big phrase, the mantra that's been on the shirts and I've been known for 29 years is proud and not satisfied. So be proud of yourself and your effort and everything that you do, but always create more goals and have something around the corner. You know, no matter how good you are, there's always somebody coming on your heels, and there's always another frontier and another thing. I always give the analogy. My mother is one of the best cooks in the world. I would put her up with Gordon Ramsay, anybody. She's very, very good. She could have her own show. I could right now drop everything I'm doing and make $250,000 selling my mom's food with a couple Uber Eats drivers in Chicago. But my mom's Thanksgiving dinner is one of the best meals you ever eat. But no matter how good it tastes, no matter how long you anticipate that meal on Thanksgiving, the next morning you wake up, you go to the bathroom, and you're hungry all over again. And that's one of the best analogies that I tell people about winning tournaments or having successes. But you have to enjoy it, love it, relish it, but you've got to get hungry again soon.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hungry dog hunts best. With pressure, I tell people often, it really in the end, it's self-inflicted pressure. I know there's peer pressure and parental pressure. Why don't you just elaborate a little bit more on pressure?
I think it's what separates in all sports. If you're really a great student of sports, then what is incredibly compelling, right? Watching the Olympics, right? How compelling is the Olympics? People train for 4 years for 10 seconds. And can you win that race or win that swimming, you know, win that 100-meter dash or whatever it is? So I'm always impressed, and I enjoy watching those critical moments. And so now in tennis, right, it's Djokovic, right? He has that ability to make fewer unforced errors and tiebreakers and just make the bar very solidly high and make somebody have to go better than him to win. And it's not that he always is hitting amazing winners or whatever. He just is saying, I'm going to make the serve. I'm going to make the return. I'm going to, you know, do all of the right things tactically and just make your life extremely difficult to win. And so he has to be comfortable in those moments though. But I think that he came to tennis at the right time, because Rafa and Roger were the talk, and he just wanted to be in that conversation for so long. And then finally he started beating them and getting in that conversation. And now, you know, he's obviously blowing all the records out of the water, but he had a hunger and a desire that's driven him to keep playing and alter his body and change his diet and change his serve and add net game. And, you know, he's done so many things that he's very deserving of all the numbers and all the records. And, you know, he's a controversial guy, but he's also a warrior when it matters. And I have a lot of respect for that. And so whoever it is, it doesn't matter whether it's Tom Brady, whether it's Michael Jordan, whoever, when you watch greatness, you You see that they accept that failure is possible, but the desire and fear in them, there's more desire than there is fear in those calming moments. Where most people, it's the other side. So being able to, what Dennis Vandermeer told me, the ability to make someone consciously unconscious is one of the hardest things to do in all sports. And if once you get that lift, then you're going to be the best coach around.
No, that's so well put. With your years in the game, decades in the game now, do you think anxiety's increased? And if so, why?
Well, now it's instant gratification. Now people have cell phones, so they're instead of going out and saying, "Oh, this guy's got a bad backhand," or "This guy's got a weak second serve," everyone's going, "Oh, this guy has an 8.3 UTR, and he beat Johnny 4-2 last time," and they're circumstantially trying to gauge where they are versus someone instead of doing the real work, which is going and scouting and then playing the first five games of a match and problem solving. So there's too much angst in children now as they go out to compete. And the levers that control college tennis, recruiting, you know, the tennisrecruiting.net and the UTRs and the WTNs and all these other things, they penalize. They allow for some accurate understanding of how some groupings work, but if I played in the UTR tournament and I'm a lot better than Steve Smith and I beat Steve Smith 7-5, 2-6, 7-5, well, I still beat Steve Smith, but I was working on my net game and coming in, well, I'm penalized now because I lost more than seven games, so my UTR is going to go down. So now you have kids that not only have anxiety before the match, they have anxiety during the match just based on winning sets and games. And so, yeah, ideally it'd be great if you just had an iPad on every court, the kids could push in the score, and then the strength or the closeness of a match could just be total points, percentage of total points, but it's not. They use these other levers. And so the UTR is seven games and WTN is winning a set. So if people hit those markers but still win and they were working on their game, they're actually penalized now. So, and then to make it worse, if I'm a blue chip player and a college coach is looking at my record and I've only played 19 matches in the last year because I've been hiding, just hoping that I'm going to get a scholarship without putting my neck on the line, some coaches are still looking at those players and saying, "Oh, maybe they can help us," or comparing them to the foreigner that they're going to recruit and saying, "Okay, maybe he's in," instead of saying, "Wait a minute, why aren't you doing your work? Why aren't you competing? You got to compete once you put my jersey on your back, so why aren't you doing your work before I give you the scholarship?" So I just think it's now there's some environmental and ranking and things that are great, but also can be challenging. So I'm trying to do the right thing and educate parents and tell them to take the high road and do the right things. And at least in my camp, I've had enough success. You know, 11 kids going to play college tennis, 9 D1, and 2 D3 this year. So I've got enough of that going on that people can trust and believe in my system. But across the country, a lot of other coaches don't have the same leverage.
You mentioned Dennis Vandermeer. I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with Dennis Vandermeer. Before we went on air, you mentioned the Mount Rushmore of coaches. What other coaches come to your mind besides Dennis?
I met Nick Bollettieri many times. One time I was at Eddie Herr. One of my students, Drew Everly, beat one of his students. And what happened was Nick's student was 15. He was under a contract. There was a lot of pressure on the kid. The kid was making some bad calls and giving my student the business. And obviously we're at Bollettieri. He's a Bollettieri kid. We're not going to get the calls, right? So my student, Drew, true story, pulls a fast one on the kid. And actually the score was 4-3 for my kid. And he was going to the side with the wind at his back. And he said it was 5-4 for him. And so there was this huge argument, and my guy ended up winning the game, winning the set, breaking because he could break him with the wind at his back, and he won the set, and then he ended up winning the match, and the other kid went crazy. And Bollettieri came up to me and said, "Your kid should be going to Harvard for those smocks." and it was funny, but obviously I wasn't condoning, you know, but it was one of those situations where Nick knew his guy was doing some cheating. and no refs were really coming to my kid's aid. And my kid kind of stood up for himself. And afterwards, Nick took me to his office and we talked, and he talked to me about development and coaching, and told me that, you know, he talked to me about business and business models and how to get paid. And so it was really an eye-opening experience. I played, you know, Rick Macy, obviously, is on the Mount Rushmore. I was coaching zonals one year, and my fight was delayed. So I was waiting, and I heard about this Rick Macy. I heard this guy, he was at the Inverary. I said, well, I'm going to go. That's on my way to the airport in Fort Lauderdale. I'm going to go over there and see if I can watch this guy work. So I go over. I'm standing on the side watching, and then Rick comes up to me, goes, hey, buddy, can I help you? And I said, well, I was here for zonals. I'm waiting for a flight. I heard that, you know, you were a great coach. I just wanted to ask permission if I could just watch you work. I'm happy to pay for the lesson or pay you a fee to sit here and just watch you coach. And he looked at me like, what? He thought I was kidding. I had cash in my hand. I said, I'm here to watch you coach, and I'm happy to pay if that's okay, if I have permission to watch this. He said, hey, buddy, you're on. So I watched the lesson. He was working with a woman named Tina Pisnik, who ironically, you know, became top 60 in the world and actually worked in Chicago for many years. And at the end of the lesson, I came up to Rick, I handed him the cash, and he said, man, I'm not taking your money. I just want to see if you were a stand-up guy. And he took me into his office, and he talked to me about a bunch of things, and about development and fundamentals, and talked to me about his what he did with Serena. And so it was just another one of those experiences, right? And there's so many opportunities I've had where great, great coaches have taken time to share and show me things. The great Bill Timm, who's, you know, obviously a USPTA Hall of Famer, has this philosophy about four ways that you should train the volley. You should train the reflex volley. You should train the standard volley that most people are training. You should train a lunge volley when you're trying to cover a passing shot up the line. And you should work on a player coming from the baseline, taking, you know, approach volleys and swing volleys from deeper in the court and tracking balls in time and space. So that's not Mark Bay philosophy. That's Bill Timm. And I use that to this day. And clearly, Ben Shelton, who we know has done quite well, his dad, Brian, was trained in that system. So there's a lot. I could go on and on. I think I'm one of the best mentored coaches in America. I think that so many great, great coaches took the time to share with me. And whenever I have the opportunity, and now I'm doing a lot with that. I'm doing academy visits and consulting and USPTA talks. And so I'm probably making 10 to 15 contributions a year now and trying to spread the gospel, because Wayne Bryan taught me that same thing. And he's the last one I will say. There was a competition training center meeting in Florida, and Wayne put some numbers on the board, 85, 17, 4, 2, all these things. And these were how many kids were in his program, how many kids were going to the sectionals, how many kids had national. Like, he had these numerical benchmarks and checkpoints. And he said, once you get to these, then these other great things can come. And I took that to heart. I took copious notes and went back. And obviously, I met those guys back when they were 12. But a lot of the things that Wayne talked about in that speech, I've kept as KPIs for my programs over the years. And I've had, obviously, a steady stream now. I'm starting my fifth generation. I consider 8 years a junior tennis generation. I'm 33 years in, so I'm in my fifth generation of coaching. And I've had somebody, I've got four kids going to the Easter Bowl. I've had somebody in nationals and somebody in the big tournaments all the time since the very beginning. And I've been able to keep the continuity because I've had these goals that have been put on me. I've not been relishing on whatever the more recent successes have been.
Let me ask you one more question before we get into the Bryans. I mean, you could write volumes. You could write several books on your relationship, your time with the Bryan family. But what about Tom Gully, Tom Gullickson? He's been in Chicago. You've interacted with him. I know he recently left, right?
Yes, I do. It's nice to get a Packer fan out of here. Gully, wonderful person. And my first big opportunity with Gully was when Gully was the Davis Cup captain and the U.S. team was playing in Milwaukee. And he had Jan Michael Gamble, Todd Martin, Currier, and Bob Bryan as a hitting partner on the team. And Gully allowed me to bring a couple of my top young students from McFetridge into the tie, gave us badges, let us sit behind the scenes, watch everything. And just, he didn't have to do that, right? But he allowed me to sit there and be at a Davis Cup behind the scenes right there. And what did that do for my coaching? What if that, how did that inspire those two young kids that went on to have scholarships in college, right? Like just all of that. So I really, I'm thankful, and Gully has continued to, we continue to stay great friends. And in 2022, he played in my doubles fundraiser and was just had a blast. So I've kept a relationship with him the entire time, and through his different stints at the USTA and all, I've always remained friends, and just have utmost respect, because there are very few people that can go through a long, long career and say that everybody loves them. I can't find one person that says they don't love Gully.
Yeah, that's a good point. With I did a couple corporate outings with Tom, but I was fortunate to spend a lot of time around Tim. Yeah, I think both Gullies were loved. Tell us about the Bryan brothers. I think it wasn't like a young Jeff Lasky and other players from the Midwest, and you hooked up and were invited into the Wayne's Club, and then you were been fast friends for since they were like in the 12s, 14s.
That's exactly right. I met them in the 12s. They were playing in the Copper Bowl, Fiesta Bowl. That was a big stretch. Those two tournaments back to back in Arizona, and those started when I was a kid. So those were tournaments that I had access to as a kid trying to make a name for himself in tennis, but couldn't get into the big national because I couldn't win in the back draw at the Midwest Close, right? I was losing the, you know, in these tournaments, whatever. I lost to Todd Martin 7-6, 7-6 at Yorktown in the Midwest Open. And, you know, I can remember those matches just like yesterday. But the Bryan brothers I met, they were 12. I watched these guys. Of course, they're nostalgic. Novelty to see twin brothers, mirror images, and all these kind of things. You know, you get enamored by that. But to watch them play and to watch how the mom and the mom and the dad were always there. Both were there. You don't see the mom now, but Kathy was a big part of the secret sauce, and she was giving them more private than Wayne. And they were just amazing kids, and they played music. And so they just played the player party at Indian Wells yesterday. And they played music, and me and my students came, and Wayne called me up on the stage with them and asked me what the name of my group was with my students. And we yelled something inappropriate, and everybody laughed, and he gave us some tambourines, and we sang and danced. And that's how we met. That was the bond. But over time, my best players, so back in those days, a kid named Matt Horsley, he played in Notre Dame. Jeff Lasky played Illinois. Kid Malcolm Buffert. Like, these were the top guys in Chicago, but they were the top kids in the nation too. And my students would play against the Bryans in doubles, and the Bryans would always win, but it would be close. 6-2, 7-5, 6-3, 6-4, 6-1, 7-6, whatever. The Bryans would win, and Wayne would come up and say, "Boy, your boys played well. I really like how these guys are playing." And so he and Kathy invited me to lunch and picked my brain, and they really liked what I stood for. They liked my philosophy and everything. And then that's how I got invited to, before the Easter Bowl, bring a Lasky and a Horsley, or bring some guys together and have like a little Davis Cup battle with the twins. And then I would play against them. And back then, I was a good player still. And I could give Bob some more fits because I could come to the net. Mike would be coming in on me, so I couldn't get to the net first. And so I would play them. And Wayne said, you know, I want to give him a little Chicago style before the Easter Bowl, was what he'd call it. But many, many, you know, years, and several of my students would come and train there. Wayne loved them, loved them all like they were his own. I stayed in his house. So everything that they talk about, like them not having video games and all those, all the folklore, it's all true. They played music. They played like Risk. They played board games. They played Nerf Hoop. They did not play the video games. That was true.
Actually, with Andy Roddick now has a podcast, and I think it's going to go up fast and be the Joe Rogan of tennis podcasts for many reasons. His humor, way he speaks, but also his guests. I think, why don't you get Jimmy Connors on and ask him about Glory Connors, or why don't you get Lynette Federer and Robert Federer and find out the story behind his story. But why I say that is, tell us more about Kathy Blake. She was one behind the scenes, real good player. And I've heard the argument where the brothers will say, "Well, we could beat you when we were 10. And she said, "No, you couldn't beat us till you were 13. Kind of like Stella Sampras and Pete Sampras. Tell us a little bit more about Kathy, because Wayne is everyone, you know.
Everyone knows Wayne, because he's the front. But yeah, Wayne was the architect of the plan, and Kathy was the nurturing mother that just they would get out of school at 1:45, get to the club at 2, and they would put in 4 hours every day. But they were able to keep straight A's and get, you know, gym and study hall at the end of the day so they could get out. And so between 2 and 4, they would get half an hour privates. Wayne and Kathy weren't giving 4 hour privates because they had too many mouths to feed. So they'd give a half an hour private on a shot. So the twins would get half an hour privates. And then they would play sets with other kids. And then the clinic would be 4 to 6, and there would be 80 kids across 17 courts. And Wayne would be calling out the rotations, and they would be doing all of the games and the drills. And the class would always finish on this just crazy high, just fun and laughter and some just pressure-filled game. And everyone's watching, and all the parents are watching. And so the practice, instead of practices finishing with kids playing points or kind of finishing on like a quiet low, Wayne always had that thing humming where at the end, everybody was jacked, everybody was walking. And for business, if the kid got into the car just amped, they could barely even go to dinner because they were so excited about whatever they were just doing. The parents were going, man, I want to keep putting my kids in that program. So he did it right from a business standpoint as a Pied Piper. And Kathy, she just talked to strategy. She talked to the boys. She gave them the private lessons. She talked to them about working together, plan as a team. And she had a really good eye. Obviously, she's the Wimbledon quarterfinalist herself. And you got the maiden name right as Kathy Blake. And so till this day, she's still integral. And she wrote me, and she and Wayne both called me and have really just heartfelt, just positives to say to me when Bob announced that I was going to be a Davis Cup assistant coach. And then afterwards when we won. So they've been supporters of me, and I've been loyal supporters of them from the very beginning. And so I kept up with Mike and Bob through college, and I've been at every NCAA since 1998 when Mike and Bob won 4-0 over Georgia at Georgia, which is still to me one of the best teams that's ever played college tennis. I think Craig Tiley's 2003 team is amazing too, because there was 6 guys with one hand backhands, all 6 feet tall or taller. So Craig had a unique dynamic there, but that Stanford team with Goldstein at 1 and Mike Bryan at 2, Bob Bryan at 3, Ryan Walters at 4, Jeff Abrams 5, and Alex Kim, who became top 200 in the world, playing 6th in his freshman year, not even getting any scholarship money. Just picture that. So that's started my NCAAs. And so when Mike and Bob were young and they were starting on the tour, there was a tournament called the RCA in Indianapolis that they were playing. And they said, hey, Bay, why don't you come over? So I came over, practiced with them, and they had a good week. They lost in the semis. They had a good week. They liked practice and some of the drills and me working, giving them some extra serving reps because Mike didn't want to blow out his arm, giving Bob extra returns, and Mike liked to get more righty returns. And so they had some lefty coaches, Phil Farmer, Dave McPherson. So I became a guy that was a scout and a hitting partner and really a return to serve practice guy for them for many, many years. So 2003 was my first year doing multiple tournaments in the year with them. And in the very first tournament, they won the title in Cincinnati in 2003. And we never looked back. And so 17 years later and many, many Master Series and Slams, just great, great.
Yeah, I know memories. You've been a permanent fixture in the box at the US Open with the Bryan brothers.
Couldn't have asked for more, and been around the world, been in Australia, been in many, many of the top cities in the world. And but yeah, it was probably like five tournaments, six weeks, depending on the year and if it was a Davis Cup in there or whatever. But it was always around my junior schedule when I could get away from the junior grind and have a little bit of a break. And the break was substantial because it was, well, certainly enjoyable with just the utopia of Mike and Bob start out hitting, they don't miss into the net for like 13 minutes.
you're the one that taught me. I'd watched him practice so many times, but when you tell the listeners, I had seen this many times, but then you told me what they were doing. They go out and the first, you just try to hit 500 balls from the get-go. Why don't you touch upon that?
Yeah, and it's quality balls too, because when they first started, they would have to hit in the alley in very narrow spaces and make all the shots. and they would have to compete against one another, right? So if Bob got 50 and Mike got 47, Mike was pissed and so forth. So just they have that natural twin Spidey sense rhythm, and they kept feeding each other's rhythm. And you've never seen guys hit volleys at each other so hard and keep making them, and just all the different things. Their professionalism is just, it's obviously, I'm fortunate hanging around on the tour. You see it. There are some camps that are just, they get it. It's not just the Bryan brothers, but they're not going to get a more professional outfit and not going to get more balls hit in a 30-minute warm-up than those guys. Just total balls hit.
Yeah, you can get on YouTube. Wayne calls it, I know he's a funny guy. He says, my kids would be bagging groceries if it wasn't for the Romanian drills with Nastasi and Tyriac.
That's right. But he understood. And it was tough. Obviously, they were both playing tournaments, both playing challengers, both doing well, but Bobby was doing a little bit better. And so all of a sudden, you have one brother that could be on pace to be top 50 and one brother that could be maybe top 120. And that starts to break them up. So to this day, Mike has a couple more doubles titles because Bob is still in another city playing singles, and Mike picked up a partner and still won. And so it's like wherever Mike touches turns to gold.
And then even at the end where Bob was having with hip surgery and Mike won with Jack Sock, right?
Wins a couple. So Bobby has more total titles because of challengers and mixed doubles, but Mike is the winningest doubles player of all time.
I like what Patrick McEnroe says. When he was their Davis Cup captain for a long time, he said the Bryan brothers get pumped up for breakfast. It's a delight to watch those guys practice.
Yeah, and great people.
I communicated with Wayne on the Vic Braden Library because he was very close with Vic, and you know Andy Fitzell and Vic, you know, had, there's film of Andy and Vic working with the Bryan brothers, but within the Tennis Channel has a library. But Kathy Blake, Wayne would get excited and say, "Oh no, our kids were always competing; they weren't taking lessons." But then Bob said, "Well, just that. My dad always gets excited, but our mom helped us with her strokes every day." And I know that they were in tune with Braden's homework.
They played classical. They really did. And yeah. So their games evolved once they got bigger, but they were so small. They just were so small for so many years. Their driver's licenses, I think it might have been 5'6", 105 or something. To think that they're 6'2½" and 6'3", and obviously.
I do think, and you could certainly comment on this, that tennis parents should dig out the book, get a copy of Wayne's book. I mean, because they're Renaissance kids. I mean, with going to Stanford, so obviously they took care of the academics, but they're musicians, so they were the triple threat.
That's exactly right. They really were, and I was stressed at home. And his book at this point now is a required reading for kids in my program. I buy boxes of them from Wayne, and any new kid that comes in, I just hand the parent the book.
No, that's great. It's a great tip for people listening. With the Davis Cup, tell us about that. Your most recent outing with them, where was it? You played in Lithuania, is that right?
That's correct. I was fortunate that I was able to go. I have a top junior right now that's top 80 in the world, ITF, and he was 5 out on the Australian Open cut. And he chose not to go to Australia to play qualies and then to go to Costa Rica to play grade ones instead. So I was supposed to be in Australia, but I wasn't. And then the United States was scheduled to play Ukraine February 1st and 2nd. And Ukraine, because of the state of unrest, not able to have a home tie. We lost a coin flip, so the coin flip's not in the States. And Mike had gone, obviously, to Croatia. When they were playing in Croatia, I was at home just sending notes to them on anything I could see based on what was going on to try to support them, because I've always, done that. And I had been walking around a little bit with Bob at the U.S. Open, scouting and watching some players. So I kind of kept up with that and watched the Davis Cup tie. Unfortunately, no, they lost. It was very close. They didn't get into the final eight, but I was supporting them. And so Mike decided he was going to take the tie off and not go to Lithuania. He's got some young kids, and Mike, you know, opted not to go. And he said, why don't you ask Bay to go? So Bobby called me and said, hey, I want to know if you were available, you were interested. I have to get it approved by the USTA, but I'd like you to go. I said, Bob, obviously, I'm happy to go and support the team and help you. And so he talked to the USTA, and the powers that be approved it. And so then we left, and we went out there for 8 days and spent the time and practiced and got the team ready to go. And it was just an amazing facility, 27, 28 courts, places busy at 11 o'clock at night, all kinds of play site data and miles per hour speeds on serves and ground stroke data to the consumer on the courts. And it was wild. Just a truly magnificent facility with a full restaurant and just a perfect place. Who knew? In the middle of Lithuania in the dead of winter, right? But we went there, had a great experience. Bob is, he runs a tight ship. The players respect him. They know what he's done. They understand so much about what Davis Cup means to him. And he leads without trying to be too big of a rah-rah guy. He does it his way, but the schedule, the plan, everyone's on the same page. It was difficult because Taylor got there a little late because he did well at the Australian Open. So it took a little longer for him to get there, but he got there, got in the fold, and everybody was on marching to the same beat of the drum, and a great team win. Sebastian Korda had a very tight match in the first round, playing, I would say, into the guy's strength a little bit too much. But it's hard when you're nervous sometimes to change the patterns, and we got through that one, 6-3 in the third. And then Chris Eubanks played because Taylor was still feeling a little uneasy about his leg. He was a little worried about his hip, which he felt he pulled when he was playing Joker. And so Chris Eubanks stepped in there and played just a beautiful match, 6-3, 6-2 victory to put us up 2-0. And then Rajiv and Austin, who have played over 30 times together actually now in pros, are so focused on the practice court, very well prepared guys. And they struggled a little bit, and we lost a set there. So we lost sets. We were in some tight matches at Korda's singles and at Ram and Krychek's doubles, but got over the hump, broke it open in the third sets, won that one. And then for the dead rubber, Taylor Fritz was feeling better, so he jumped in and played the fourth match. So we won all four matches, and that was the tie. But always great to represent your country. It was an honor to be there. I learned so much from being there, and obviously I would, you know, go to the war, you know, go to the wall and go to war with the Bryans any day of the week, and was just thankful for the opportunity.
With amazing story, the Bryan brothers, they haven't really, they took over for Marty Fish. It's just been a couple of years, but I know that they have been helping Austin Krychek for a long, long time. They've been in his corner as mentors. So Davis Cup is in good hands. What an amazing experience. Chris Eubanks, Yvonne Osoretso helps so much with what we do, especially the podcast. He's a big fan of Chris Eubanks as a commentator. Why don't you talk a little bit about, I've heard you many, many times from Kalamazoo to College Day, Tennis Channel, ESPN. What comes to your mind if you just to share a few thoughts on being a commentator?
I think that commentary is a way to bring life and light to tennis matches. And I have a nickname, and my nickname is Baywatch. People have been calling me that for a long time. And it's not because I like blondes running on the beach. Obviously, my last name is Bay, and people always felt like I was perceptive and intuitive and had good takes on things. And so to be able to bring to light some of the nuances of what's going on, maybe some things that people don't see, maybe some backstory, to add that gloss and that color. That's why it's called a color commentary. I just feel that's so important and so needed for our sport. And so anytime I get a chance to get in a booth with whoever, you know, I've been at the U.S. Open here the last couple of years, and that's been fun to rub elbows with Leif Shiris or Robbie Koenig or know, some of these industry stalwarts. But I feel that there's a lot more to just saying, well, he has 37 winners and 19 errors, and you know, he's got to be more consistent, or whatever. So I enjoy that. And for me, being able to call the juniors and the college and the pros, often I've seen everybody's life cycle, and most certainly, right? I call Austin Krajicek Kalamazoo final when he won 2007. So it's really the ultimate compliment. And I'll give you a great story about my Kalamazoo commentary. Jack Sock was getting ready to play his first Kalamazoo final, 3 out of 5 sets. And his mother was a little nervous, and she was getting ready to leave the hotel to come over to watch. And she turned on the public access network in Kalamazoo, and the match had already kind of begun. She was getting ready to come over after the first set had started to watch Shaq. And she listened and heard my commentary, and she enjoyed it so much and felt like it was soothing to her because she was nervous, and she felt like it was descriptive, and she liked what I was talking about, that she watched almost the entire match from the hotel and didn't come over until later. When Jack won, because she enjoyed it that much, and she reached out to me and told me that was one of the biggest compliments I'd ever gotten. But I feel that the thing that people don't know about commentary is how well prepared. It doesn't matter whether you're Sam Gore or Andrea Petrovic or whoever it is that's out there doing the work. It's just, there's so much preparation that goes into being able to be seamless on air and deliver the content and the words and the story and bring to light what's going on. And so I have the utmost respect for everybody that does the craft. And whenever my number is called, I'm always happy to make that contribution. And it's been fun here these last two U.S. Opens to do that work for the world feed.
Well, as someone for yourself who's been in the trenches, I do think that many times obviously the players the players with a microphone, you know, they certainly have amazing pedigree. When I ran a program where we had 2 years, we'd have a lab, and I remember we just did it a handful of times where some young student, maybe older student, because we had career change people retired from the military, said, I want to be a commentator. So we'd film a match and makeshift like our podcast table, and it was miserable. I mean, that you really have to, you have great communication skills, very articulate, and then you know the game, you've lived the game, but it's not easy. I think like Roddick with his podcast now, that like we're doing this session, is you can elaborate on certain points, but when you just get that sound bite where, you know, it's just in between points, there's so much to it. But it's great with in your notes here, maybe you've already said it, but you're such a great speaker. You have down defining moment. You send me a list of a dozen points. It's just the one I haven't touched upon. What's the Mark Bay defining moment?
Well, I would say that there's all kinds of defining moments, right? And my particular journey. So I'd say my first defining moment was 11 years old, beating my aunt for the first time at the park and driving home, and she was pissed. And that was the first time. She's the first opponent that I had, first person I had to beat, right? And that was a defining moment, right? Being able to win my first trophy, right? That was a defining moment. My first trophy was a ping pong trophy, not even a baseball or a basketball or a tennis. And so just having these esteemed moments in your life. Like I mentioned before, when Rajesh Kuruvilla won the Midwest Close, I felt like a coach star was born. In McFetcher Sports Center, right? $8 an hour court time. So there's just been so many of those, obviously moments, right? And I think that getting the opportunities to work with some of the families that I've worked with, and my first time on Tennis Channel was 2011. I did a show called The All Court Player with a young lady named Breanne Miner, and that video is now a legendary video. Showed all the things I did with her when she was 11 years old, and she was going through growth and development and all. And now, she went on to be a top national ranked player, be the first African-American NCAA champion at the University of Michigan in singles and played Ons Jabeur at the U.S. Open. And so there's all of these little moments and periods, right, where you get these chances to shine. And I've had a lot of them, and definitely extremely sentimental moment when the Bryan brothers were there for my Hall of Fame induction. My mom was there for only the fourth time in my tennis career. So those were, you know, there's a lot of them, I think, you know, going on through my history and my story. And hopefully I've got a few more left in me. I think I've got a few more good years left. So I'm going to keep on keeping on and get out here. And,
that's fantastic. I mean, there's so many things you've said that just remind me of this and that, and one story leads to another. But Ricardo Acciolo, who I've known for a long, long time, he talked about a defining moment for him. He talked about when he finally could beat his mother in tennis, and he said he started drop shotting her. And I'm going, come on, you were drop shotting your mom.
That's kind of mean.
It's fantastic to have you on as a guest, Mark. I appreciate it. I would say this is Mark Bay's the lifer, the passion, the psychic income. Obviously, you don't do it for the money. And it's great for people to hear your voice. Anything that you want to ask? We've got the Englishman at the table here. He's here studying as a coach, so he's here for 2 months. And I said, hey, this would be a great opportunity for you to listen to Mark Bay.
I like your messaging, Mark. And the one question I have for you, what keeps you inspired every day? What keeps the fire burning?
I think that I've evolved. I think that I've been able to give myself a varied contribution in the sport. So I'm still going to be rolling up my sleeves and doing all of that trench work, right, for a good 35 hours a week, always. And then on top of it, I can do some consulting. I can do some commentary. I can go do some public speaking. I can do a podcast today. I have these other pieces, right? That, because I think that looking at the same four walls for 33 years, I think people can get burned out. And so because I've been able to find a way to make other contributions, and I have a systematic brain, so I'm good at systems and organizing, and so being able to offer people content, and also, you never know, right? I did well for the Bryans for 17 years, and then obviously I get trusted to have a Davis Cup job. You know, you don't see that coming, right? But that's just one of those karma things that comes back your way. But I've been around long enough now to have some positive things come my way. I've done right by a lot of people and given this great game of tennis to so many and so many great lives. And what people never talk about is how many, I have a kid named Nick Kramaitis who was a Forbes 30 under 30. And I've got a girl, Julia Schroeder, now. She's just about to finish graduating Michigan Med School. And, how many of those stories do I have? Right? It's hundreds now.
Jim Lehrer's storytelling for mental toughness.
That is your currency. That is your marketing, that is your, so I don't have an Instagram. You're not going out on YouTube and seeing me on a bunch of videos and I'm showing my latest and greatest student or this, that, and the other, because I'm just too busy trying to make sure that the people that respect me in the program are getting where they need to go. And ultimately all the other things come out in the wash. So been very blessed, extremely grateful. And like I said before, I think I've got a few more good years left. So I'm going to give the best I can to everybody that hires me.
Well, let me say two more things. One, my son played at Ohio State. I was at the Big Ten. You're there, and Ohio State wins, and there's a party afterwards with the players and parents, and Baywatch is there. So I said to Mark, I go, hey, if Michigan won, would you be in their party? And you said, yeah. And I think that you could write a book, The Insider's Insider. But how would people get a hold of you if they wanted to get in contact with Mark Bay?
There's two ways. Mark Bay 13, number 13, which is my favorite number, markbay13@gmail.com is my email. And then my cell number, 773-505-0954. I have a very small group of friends on Facebook, so I don't add much there. I like to keep that with close-knit people that I'm very tight with over the years. And I don't have an Instagram yet. I will eventually have a business Instagram as I start trying to launch more products that are not just on the court types of things. With, like I said, this Academy Visit consulting business that I started in 2023 and some of these other things that I'm offering. So there will be down the road a business Instagram that people can connect to. But at this point now, you know, the email and the cell phone is great.
Mark, what about the USPTA courses, lectures, specialty courses, things that you've done? People can get it.
Those are on tennisresources.com. And I did six of those for the USPTA. The first one with Breanne Miner in 2011 was the all-court player. And I did six of them as part of a content group with, you know, Rick Macy and Emilio Sanchez and others that were doing these. And so my first one was the all-court player. My second one was competitive drills and games, like things that have substance that people can do and practice. My third one was called the Jigsaw Puzzle Theory, the 10 things that I think all top national juniors have to have to be successful. The fourth one was called the Complete Two-Hand Backhand. So instead of people saying that Sampras has got to change his two-hander to become a one-hander to win Wimbledon, like really talk about how from ground up to teach a two-hand backhand where there's a competent slice and a great backhand volley and everything is part of the Complete Two-Hand Backhand. And then the Art of Approaching 1 and Art of Approaching 2. So there were six of these DVDs that were out there and that aired on Tennis Channel and then were sold and now subsequently are part of tennisresources.com.
No, that's great. Mark, appreciate your time. We need to do this another time. I mean, so you're so busy, but I really appreciate it. I know our listeners, we call it a tennis treasure chest, and obviously you share golden nugget after golden nugget.
But, yeah, so thankful to do it and appreciate everything that you did for me, Steve, and that you came out to my event. And you know, shout out to all of those guys. Shout out to Nick Saviano, who talked to me about how to have, you know, really good structure with my coaching. Shout out to Chuck Creasy, that talks about, you know, old school and the importance of the traditional match and making kids uncomfortable out there and learning how to not be afraid of situations that can make you stronger. But just so many people that have been there and helped me throughout my process and my journey. So I'm thankful for everything that I've done. And like I said, proud and not satisfied. I got more to do.
Like that. Proud but not satisfied. Mark, again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be in touch. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
All right, Mark. Bye, Mark.
Cheers.
Okay. The Englishman. He really is English. He's not from Missouri. I smell the blood of an Englishman. Mark Bay, great speaker. Wow. He's got a story to tell. That was fantastic to listen to, Mark. What are your thoughts? Just to wrap it up here.
Yeah, a lot really. Got a lot of notes, but yeah, like his concepts, like his outlook, and it just sounds like he gives more than he takes. It's similar to you, Steve. He seems like a student of the game. And he's there for the added value, not just
added value. I think. Exceed expectations.
Mm. He's got good work ethic as well. He seems like he's got a real drive to, yeah.
With I said this about Joel Trucker. We need to go back and take notes, and then we can have a podcast just on the notes. We are going to take steps forward. We're actually. Leaving here today, we're going to go to Charlotte and do a workshop. We're going to meet with Sophia Patel, who's working with us now. She was a guest on our podcast. I recommend people to go listen to that. She's going to work as a network coordinator. We do have a network. We're certainly not as organized as we need to be. With Great Base Tennis, it is a nonprofit. Our efforts are to carry the torch for tennis teachers from the past, share educational content. Even if it's a dollar, if you wanted to go to, we're not so good on the commercial side, sell. I do think that tennis teachers have to teach, organize, and sell. I don't really like that, but be convincing, be persuasive. But yeah, if you could go to our website. There is a donate button. What we'll do is we'll follow up. Just some of the things that Mark touched upon. So many things to go back and go into detail. Dave Fish, who was a guest on our podcast, said the one thing about podcasts is going back in time. It's like talk radio. And really, in the end, thank you, Mark Bay. Thank you. It was great to hear him talk tennis. The Englishmen were on their way to a tennis workshop. We're going to try to help people out with the game. Adios, amigos. Wave goodbye the camera. Give us that hockey player smile. Come on. I love that hockey player smile. Another episode in the books, 188. The Englishman, your mother loves you.
I hope so.